well, your age, where you were born.
Well, I was born in Winnipeg in 1913 in the Grace Hospital. And I've always been interested in music. And therefore, I belonged to the Sea Cadet Band at an early age, and I played horn, and I became first trombone and euphonium, and work. There was very little work in my time of life. I worked in the fur store delivering furs around Winnipeg.
Which company was this?
This was the Alaska Fur Company. The man's name was Mr. Fred, and I believe he's still living. And strangely enough, one of the officers of the Sea Cadets happened to work there too, Mr. Jim Baird, who told us many interesting stories about his military life in the American Marines. I'd forgotten this. And how they would march down the street and go in the Japanese bathhouses. And little did I know that I would see it all come through, that I would be walking down the street and see the Japanese walking down the street on a cold winter day. The temperature would be about 25 above. And they would be walking down with a kimono on. It would be open, and they would be as red as lobsters, and the steam would just be rising from them, men and women, you see. So you never know what's really going to happen to you, you see. So then I joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers militia band under Bandmaster Hall, who was a very fine musician, and we had a very, very good band. It had been originally conducted by possibly Canada's finest conductor, Mr. J.P. O'Donnell. And I had studied with Mr. O'Donnell for 3 or 4 years, harmony and theory, and it all stood me in good stead in later years when I got a job in a theater playing the theater orchestra. I was able to play just every type of music. I had the background of the military band, all the standard overtures, and I had played in the Canadian Legion Concert Orchestra under Mr. Yetman, and a very famous oboe player, I've just forgotten his name now, may come to me, still out of the University of Manitoba. And so I really made my living in music, other than a short period in the grain exchange.
And what was your job in the grain exchange?
Well, I was marking the prices on the board, and then the stock price came, so I didn't have a job. Half the grain exchange closed down, so I went shining shoes then for the man that was the head of the Sea Cadets, Mr. J.R.K. Milne. A lot of people will remember him. And he didn't like the idea of paying 15 cents for a shoe shine, so he opened a place called Dine Shine on the corner of Portage and Fort. It was in Club Cigar Store. A man by the name of Mr. Groley was the manager there, big fat German, typical looking German, very jolly, smoked a Meerschaum pipe. And I'll tell you what this Mr. Milne said now. Some people may take offense. We didn't in those days. He didn't like getting on a greasy stool and having his shoes shined by a greasy Greek. This is what he said. And he'd just come back from Chicago, and there was a shoe shine parlor there that had office-type chairs, like a swivel chair. It was all spanking brand new. It was the latest equipment. And he thought if he could import that here and hire a man to train the boys, because work was so hard. So he got about 12 of us boys from the Sea Cadets to volunteer, and they put us into two shifts, morning and evening shifts. We worked very long hours, 7 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night, the split shifts. And the happiest days then was when it rained, because we were only 100 steps from the Orpheum Theater. And any time it rained, the boss said, away you go, and we knew what he meant, that nobody would get their shoes shined when it rained. So we'd run down to the Orpheum and pay our money and go in there and watch the show and ask the usher to tell us if it stopped raining, and then we'd have to go run back because people would then come out and want the shoes cleaned. Strangely enough, you see. So that was my first early work. And then I, all this time I was playing the Sea Cadet Band, and then when I left shining the shoes, and I worked in Eaton's grill room for a short time, washing dishes and pots and pans, and still practicing the trombone. I played in the St. Boniface City Band. They provided the instrument, and finally it paid off. They needed a promo play in the theater, and I went out and auditioned and I got it. So I was 4 years there.
What theater was this?
That's right where you are. The Beacon Theater, and it's right where the Museum of Natural History is, right on that very corner of Rupert. Isn't that amazing? And it was a very popular theater in Winnipeg because they had their picture show and their American acts of vaudeville and their nine-piece band. In fact, I came across a picture just tonight while we were looking of some of the members of the band, and I had written on the back, Jack Sorn, Marsh Fimister, missing. And those are the only two fellows that aren't alive today. Jack Sorn got shot in a love affair in Los Angeles about 12 years ago. And of course, Marsh Fimister,
recently.
Yeah, he was killed in an automobile accident. He sat next to me in the football bomber games most of the time. And I had to smile with all the people that knew him and the things they said about him. It was all baloney, and yet they didn't come to the people that really worked with him. And it's the way it is. Everybody wants to get into the act and, oh, yes, I know more if you're a fine musician. Oh, as you see, well, he was really an entertainer. He wasn't. We never considered him a musician, as such. He was an entertainer and a good entertainer. So I think that's about enough for the personal part. Mm-hmm. As far as the dispatch to Hong Kong, well, we were just sent to Jamaica first and lived down there for 18 months. Came back, had about a month off here. And said we were going to another tropical country. They issued us tropical kit. And as I recall it, we weren't told we were going to Hong Kong until we were at least a week out at sea. That's the way I remember it. I could be wrong, for a day or two. And then shortly after we left Manila, we were actually told that we might have to fight our way off the boat. And I don't know where the rumor came from, but I know that must be true because I think I have read every book about American intelligence, Japanese intelligence, all the fighting and all the campaigns, hundreds and hundreds of books, and they knew, the British knew, but the Americans wouldn't listen to them. Well, there's a new one coming out now by Ladislaus Faragas. He's got a book coming out, something about the voice of the foxes or something, but I read his Broken Seal, and it's just a marvelous account of the raid on Pearl Harbor. And the many, many warnings that they had broken the Japanese code years before. They had duplicated their coding machines, and yet they wouldn't even tell President Roosevelt because they were afraid somebody in his office would find out. So it's really an amazing thing.
Arrival in Hong Kong
the only thing I remember about arriving in Hong Kong is walking down the gangplank, and then right away the land seemed to come up. After all, we were 29 days at sea, I think, zigzagging the whole way. So we were escorted by, I think it was a boat called the Prince Robert, if I'm not mistaken. It had been a peacetime boat, but it was converted into an armed merchant cruiser, I think they called it. And we marched down the main street. We marched down Nathan Road, I remember that, to a place called Sham Shapoe Barracks. I was in the band. We were assigned to some buildings called the Jubilee Buildings, right on the seafront. And it didn't take us long to hire a few boys, as they call them. And they shined all your buttons and pressed all your clothes. And they did everything. And it was quite the life, as long as it lasted, for the 2 or 3 weeks that it lasted. The poor chap got his head blown off, unfortunately. He stayed in that building when the first bombs dropped, and when some of our fellows went back there, they found him laying there with his head knocked off.
Was there any training done at this time after your arrival in Hong Kong?
Well, there was very little training. We did some training on the boat, but there really wasn't any much to train with. Seems to me they had one boy's anti-tank rifle, if I can remember. It was an outmoded thing. It fired a tremendous slug, probably a 50 caliber or something. Can you imagine firing that from the shoulder with a big rubber pad at the back? It was a single shot thing, and of course it was supposed to penetrate a tank of those days, you see. We didn't do too much training, to be honest with you. went for some route marches to kind of get the sea out of our legs. We were there a very short time, as you probably know, you see. And the battle.
Mm.
Well, this is a...
No, where were you when the bombing started on the...
I can tell you exactly, and a guy owes me a dinner, Sergeant Major Logan. He'll be glad to hear this, because I met him 2 weeks ago, and he says, Doug, do you know I still owe you for that dinner? I said, yes, I know. He said, well, I'll pay you one of these days. We were standing on the shores of Aberdeen Reservoir. That's where we were sent. There was a pillbox dug into the side of the hill there. And that was our position. And he was the sergeant major of us and somebody else. Just forget which company it was. I'm not very good at remembering things like that because I wasn't in a company. Say, I was in battalion headquarters. Being in the band, we had taken all the first aid training and all the water courses and all those things, you see. Well, anyways, we were roused up this morning quite early and stood to, told to load our rifles and put our helmets on and our bayonets on. So it was a stand to, so we just thought it was practice. And then about 8 o'clock, we heard this very loud rumbling noise and whining noise coming through the air. And we could look across from our position and see the smoke rising. And I said, you know what, Frank? I said, that's the bloody Japs. They're attacking us. Oh, I said, don't be silly. He said, it's just a practice. I said, I'll bet you the biggest dinner that money can buy that we are being attacked by the Japanese now. And don't ask me why. You're the professional soldier. Well, he said, you're wrong. We shook hands on it. Well, I was right and he was wrong. One of these days he'll buy me the dinner, he says. So then the regimental Sergeant Major Paddy Keene and I, we spent the first 2 days loading what they call Mills bombs. You have to drop the fuse in and arm them. And we just did hundreds and hundreds of cases of that. And he left to go some other place and I was left with the rest of the boys to man this pillbox. And then Major Bailey called for me and a chap named Harry Creedon. And he said, take this ambulance and try and work your way around and tell the people in the other pillbox around. He said, just follow the road. He said, you can't miss it. And tell them there'll be a hot meal for them tonight. He says, those fellows have been there for 3 days and they've had nothing to eat at all. Just their iron rations. And tell them we have got a hot meal for them and we'll get it to them tonight. But we have no phone line, so you'll have to tell them to stick it out. Well, I'll never forget what happened as long as I live. Harry was driving this car and we turned this corner and this plane came out of nowhere with machine guns rattling and plowed up all the dirt in front of us like you see in the American war battle pictures, and it was gone. Then there was a darndest bang and the road just erupted in front of us and we were in a kind of a cut and it blew a huge piece of the rock out. In this cut here and just missed us, and we realized it was a Navy ship firing from behind an island. See, this road ran along the sea, you see. So Harry turned the car around this bank and decided to go back the way we came. We couldn't get any further. They had us boxed in, you see, between this plane and this naval gunfire. So we turned around and we started to go back, and we got around one corner and there was a Chinese running towards us with a long bamboo pole and vegetables on each end of it. And the next second he was running without his head. A shell just landed right on the road and blew his head clean off, and there he was just running down. I'll never forget that. And then we got around the corner and they couldn't get at us anymore, so we never did get to that pillbox. So the rest of the time we just stayed in our position like we were told to and be ready for anything, and fired machine guns and fired at all the low flying planes that came over. And I remember that Gerald McKnight and I, oh, and his brother was our Elmer, they were twins. They started to shell our position and we decided to move out from where we were and lay down flat in some trees. And there was 13 shells landed no more than 100 feet from us, and not one of them went off. They were all duds. But the 14th, it went off, but fortunately they had raised their sights. And a huge piece, well, it sounded like, we all said it sounded like an egg beater, come coming through the bush and through the grass and the weeds and everything, you know, making and it rolled right up, and Gerald threw his head down between my legs. We all flopped down at the same time, and this huge hunk of stuff, the size of a softball, except that it was a bit hollow inside, came to rest without touching anybody. And I reached over to touch it, because it was just red hot. And it would have taken our foot off or your head off or anything had it just been that much closer. Well, that was enough for us. Anyways, we were told a little later on we had to evacuate Aberdeen, and we were going to Aberdeen Village. So we went down there somehow in the black of night. I guess you could call it a retreat, but we were told to go there. We were given a meal of sardines, rice, and canned beans on one plate, pitch black, and there was bodies all over this industrial school, as it was called, the Aberdeen Industrial School. They weren't dead, they were just tired, dog tired. We ate this meal, and I just lay down on the floor on top of somebody else, and I didn't remember anything until the next morning. I was so tired. You see, we'd been up, we'd been in rain, we'd been soaked in rain, and no regular food, and being fired upon by planes and shell fire, and very little contact personally with the enemy. There was, outside of mortar fire, we could see them actually setting up mortars and firing at us. But you see, they were on the other side of the reservoir. When daybreak came, they got the range of this house that we went to have a sleep. And there was three or four British troops in there, and they had some food, and they wouldn't give us any. I always remember that. And a couple of Indian soldiers, and a few other Canadians, and Sonny Beale, and myself. That's the only other Canadian I can remember there at the time that was with us. And the shelling got very bad, and we were just deciding that we better pull out of this house and go and lay down on the street, because we didn't know where it was coming from. They were, must have been up on the hill, and they had us just boxed in. Well, we stepped outside, and a shell hit, and there was a Chinese woman standing there, and she was crying her eyes out, and her son of about 4 years old was laying there on the ground, and half of his behind and leg was just gouged out. You never saw anything so ugly and terrible in your life. The kid couldn't live. So we looked at her, and my son Emil and I motioned to her with our rifles, and shall we kill him? And she nodded her head. So we shot the little boy. And she nodded her head again and picked him up and walked away. It was a terrible thing that happened. But, she had got no help or no mercy for anybody. For all that was bodies floating in the bay. Right now, this place I'm speaking of, by the way, is the most popular tourist place in Hong Kong today, Aberdeen Fishing Village. You'll see the beautiful floating restaurants with all the live fish there, and you go and pick out the fish you want, and they cook it for you. I'll show you some pictures later on in a book I have of Hong Kong. So, we were roaming around the hills, and we finally got down from this Aberdeen place to a hotel, and Sergeant Major Adams, his hand was very badly shot, and he was to stay there. And I picked up a Hong Kong policeman's greatcoat. It reached my ankles. He must have been a 6 foot policeman. That was the only thing I had to wear, just one of the clothes I stood in, and this greatcoat that was on the side of the road. So I picked that up and put it on, and I kept it. I had it all through the war, and I took it to Japan and everything. The guy said I looked like a monk, because it was black, you see. But it was a blanket. See, actually, it was it served as an extra blanket, because it came right down to my ankles. See, I'm trying to think of something else that happened there. Oh, yeah, we got some other orders. We were given orders to go and set up a hospital at a place called Pock Fulham. It's another reservoir. And we were told, my buddy and I, Harry Creedon, and Sonny Beale, another guy, we were told to go there and set up a hospital, because there was lots of wounded, and they would be coming there, and we were to prepare it. So we marched up there, and it was run by French monks. And me and my big mouth, they spoke no English at all. And we went in there, and they saw us, and I said, "C'est la guerre," And the guy just started off with a flood of French. He thought I could speak French, you see, and that was all I knew. And I could count to 10 in Chinese. And they had a servant. And I wanted all the bowls that they had, so I would count yak yi sam chak dum dum right up to 10. And I said, okay, I want these bowls. And then he'd come back and then I'd count again. Until we got a whole bunch of bowls, you see, to wash people with. And we took all their bedding and mattresses and blankets and everything. And it was shortly after that, before we got the hospital actually set up, that the word come through, this was Christmas Day, that we had surrendered. And there was a long wooden staircase at the back of this monastery, because it was built on the side of a hill. Must have been 100 steps, like you see in the cowboy movies, or a long set of stairs is going down to the street. And there was an English soldier down there firing a pistol up at us. And I don't know what possessed me. I just walked down those stairs as calm and walked right over to him, put my hand in my pocket, pulled out a cigarette, said, "Have you got a match?" And the pistol was on a lanyard around his neck. And he dropped the pistol and he gave me a light. And then I grabbed him with a hammer lock from behind. And then I grabbed the lanyard and they came down. I got the pistol and I shoved his back and then I screamed for my friend Harry Creedon to come. And he come flying down those stairs with lather all over him. He was having a shave. And he knocked him out. And I took the pistol and I buried it. And I guess it's still there. I guess the poor fellow just went off his head, because it was a very short time after that that we were told to leave Park Farm and assemble at a place in the peak where the Japanese were going to take over. And I don't know how many British Navy sailors I saw there with that had taken their shoe off and had killed themselves with their rifle, put it in their mouth, and blown their head off, you see. So I suppose this is what happened to that chap too. So that was pretty much the end of the battle. The Japanese weren't very happy to see us there. They herded us like cattle. Made us march a long, long way down the hills and without a stop and anything to eat or drink. And they put us in a park right in front of the Hong Kong Bank for about 6 hours in the boiling sun. Then they took us across on the ferry, the Star Ferry, to North Point Camp, if I remember right. No, to Sham Shui Po, that's right. Over to Sham Shui Po, where we started from. When we got back there, the barracks that we had vacated 17 days before, you never saw anything like it. There wasn't a doorknob, window pane, window sash, tap, electric light fixture, electric light wire. There wasn't anything. During the fighting, the Chinese had gone in there and just taken anything that would move. It all has its resale value in China. See, so we went into... Well, I'll show you a picture. Somebody drew a picture of it. Just a cement floor and no windows. So we had to scrounge around for bomb down buildings and get bricks and brick them up and just to keep the rain out. You see, it's very rainy in Hong Kong during this time. Anyways, before we had got here, though, the Japanese had lined us up someplace. I just don't know how we got there. See, it's all so hazy. But they ran out and they got a cushion for the officer that was with us. Let him sit on the cushion. And then they shot a Chinese civilian or bayoneted. I just forget which, just for nothing. But that was like them, you see, to show off. Then they started to search us, and I did this dumb thing that I was telling you about. I stepped out of the line and I walked behind the man that was doing the searching and got into the line that he had already searched, and I got away with it. And I had this pair of binoculars on my watch, you see. So I got away with that. So they were a very long time providing us any food at all. They never did provide any eating utensils. I ate out of an inverted lampshade, something like you would see in a telegraph office over the telegraphist, like a coolie's type hat, about 6 inches across, and I just rammed a piece of wood up there, and I made a wooden spoon, and that's what I had the longest time to eat the little that they gave us. And they gave us no cooking pots. We had to use oil drums that were scoured out as best they could. And we just ate twice a day boiled rice and God knows what else was in it, I don't know. And as hungry as I was, I couldn't eat it. And the strange thing was, my buddy ate everything that I couldn't eat, and we just kept on both going out exactly the same. We were just right down. I lost 40 pounds very quickly, and so did he. I couldn't force the rice down me. It took me the longest time, because I've never liked rice, you see. And then one day, somehow I got a chance to get some sugar, just a spoonful, and I found out as long as I had a few sprinkles of sugar on the rice, I could get it down. But of course, the chances of getting sugar all the time wasn't very great.
Was there much sickness at this time?
Oh yes. Well, I worked in the medical. Being trained, I worked in the MI room. And yeah, there was a great deal of sickness, and I can always remember John Crawford, Major John Crawford. He's a colonel now or higher, but I often wonder if he remembers this. And he was talking to Captain John Reed, and here's his exact words. I hope he's listening. John, he says, I give him 6 months, and there won't be one of them left. And mind you, we hadn't been prisoners any more than 8 months at that time. Now, of course, there were certain diseases that he knew that could run epidemic, of which I wasn't aware of, you see. And, but it was the beriberi and the lack of vitamins that he was concerned with, you see, that he was aware of, that we weren't. We had very little to work with. And there was a very, very unpleasant condition that affected almost everybody. The British called it strawberry balls. We just called them Hong Kong balls. The scrotum just became fiery red and shriveled up. And then the people that weren't circumcised, their foreskins closed over. And then many of them had to be sent across the island to be circumcised. Otherwise they would have actually strangled to death. And then the diphtheria epidemic broke out, and the doctor told me they were finding the diphtheria, the gray film. He showed me enough cases so I could identify it, because there was too many people and I was examining the same as he was. If I saw one that looked suspicious, I would point out, and he'd say, yeah, that's right there. They were finding it in navels and all sorts of strange places, up people's noses, this diphtheria. And of course, they had very little to fight it with. They were paying off Chinese with money they would collect and buying our own supplies back from the hospital on the island and getting it back. And I understand they found out they could give about maybe a half of the normal dose, and it would be very effective. So they were able to stretch out this anti-diphtheria toxin to a much greater extent than they would have. They just thought they would try it because there were so many people sick and they could do so little.
So how long were you at Sham Shui Po?
We were there just about a year. We got a Red Cross parcel at Sham Shui Po. It was a British Red Cross parcel. And each man in that camp got one British Red Cross parcel and 10 Canadian dollars, which had been turned into 10 yen, which bought absolutely sweet fanny. I bought a tin cup and one egg. That's what I remember I was able to get with my 10 Canadian dollars. It came in a nice envelope with a green Christmas tree printed on it, a gift from the people of Canada, $10, and then inside of it was a Japanese 10 yen. They'd taken the money and give us 10 yen for it. And that bought, as I say, sweet F.A. So we got one British Red Cross parcel after we'd been prisoners about a year. And then the Flying Tigers came over just after they'd been handed out there and sank three or four ships in the harbor there, and that really shook up the Japs pretty bad. And Then they came along one day and segregated us all, said we were going to be taken to Japan. So we were locked in behind the wire within the wire. Told we could only have 2 blankets, and anybody that tried to take more than 2 blankets would be beaten up, and they weren't fooling. And nobody could have any shoes. You had to go in their running shoes. Strange people. So they put us on a beautiful boat called the Tatsuta Maru. I know it very well because it was built from British plans. In fact, it was built in Glasgow. And she was a very fast and modern boat, except that we were put right down in the very bottom hold, and the hatches put on there. We were just absolutely like ants. Fed twice a day. They just throw a pail of rice down there and nothing to drink that I can remember. And no place to lay down. It was just horrible. So after what seemed to be ages and ages, we finally arrived at Nagasaki, and everybody was literally thrown off a boat. I could never understand that. There was a man standing there with a spray, and he sprayed everybody, and then you were passed on to the next guy, and he just took a hold of you, and he just threw you onto the gangplank. I could never understand why, but that's what they did. Then they lined us up in the trains and put us in the trains, and they gave us a box lunch of old rice and seaweed, and looked like deep fried grasshoppers. Oh, I'm not kidding, there's a grasshoppers already. And a little cup of green tea, and drew the blinds, and we seemed to be traveling for 3 or 4 days till we finally arrived in Tokyo. And there the people jeered at us and spit at us walking through the streets, and we went through the subway of Tokyo. And we were taken by train to Yokohama and into a brand new camp that no one had lived in, absolutely brand new. 2 large huts, each one held probably 300 or 400 men. So,
what was this camp called?
I think it was called 3D. I was in so many camps, but I think that one was called 3D. It was on the banks of a canal. And we found out we were to work in a shipyard. And it was just the luck of the draw. I could have been a cook, and I would have drawn the heaviest sledgehammer job, and some guy that was 500 pounds could have had a job picking up nails. It was just strange. Anyways, I got assigned to a riveting gang, which at least you burnt to death in the summer from the blazing sun and the heat of the rivet fires, but in the winter at least you were warm. And so I became an expert riveter and saboteur, I might add. We quickly learned how to put in bomb rivets and how to test the rivets for the rivet inspector so he wouldn't get his clothes dirty. And once we gained his confidence, so then we just marked all the rivets good, you see, and made sure we put in bad ones. And of course we poured sand in the rivet guns, and they were very, very short of oil, and sand in the airlines and things like that. Did anything we could to impede their progress. But it was a long day. You're up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you're counted, you went back in. This might sound strange, but the hardest job I had in my life was serving 50 men their meal. You can imagine, the Japanese army is grouped in sections of 50, and we were living in a Japanese army barracks that was built for us with a platform about 2 feet off the ground with a rice mat on it, and a place just wide enough for a man to lay down on. And there was 25 on each side. That was your 50. That was your section. And they had a section leader, a hancho. And if you can imagine, 49 vultures sitting over you while you're serving the meal, the breakfast meal. And there wasn't very much time to do it. You had to serve that meal, eat it yourself, and get out to be counted again. You count it when you get up in the morning. You come in, you serve the meal, you go again. The work party is counted. You're marched to work. You're counted then. You were split up into the gangs. Then your gang foreman took you over, and he counted you. Then he marched you to the part of the ship that you were working in. Then he counted you again. Then you drew your tools, and they were all locked up because the Japanese are the greatest thieves in the world, at least during the war they were. They had to lock all the rivet hoses up, all the solid brass taps for regulating the air. Everything. Oh, I'll tell you. And so then we started, they started in to show us how to rivet without one word in English. Just a rifle butt, that's all, and you learn. We just practice on sheets of plating, that's all. Learn how to put the rivets up, how to heat them, how to put the tool up underneath that holds the rivet in place, and then put the different heads in the gun to press it down, how to measure for the rivets. You left an inch and 3/8 protruding above the work, and then you hammer this down into the round thing, you see. So we became quite proficient at riveting, and when we left that shipyard nearly 3 years later, we were the number one riveters of the shipyard. We were working on the bottom of the boat, which was only reserved for the expert men. But of course, by this time, the labor gang had changed so much, and all these men that had been working on the bottom boat had been called up into the armed service, and they were bringing more and more children and university students in, you see. Well, by this time, I was the only one, I would say, that I don't know of anybody else that could read Japanese. There were quite a few, spoke it quite well, especially the French. We had a French regiment with us. And if you write out a Japanese word into English, and a person doesn't speak English very well, then their French accent holds them in good stead. They say it quite nicely, you see. But Japanese is a very strange language. There's no accents in it at all. It's just all flat. And it always sounds like that they're mad at you all the time, you see. And you just have to get used to this. So I learned the three types of Japanese writing. One is 100% Chinese, and all very educated Japanese write in Chinese, you see, to show that they're educated. But of course, they intersperse it with certain Japanese endings because they're easier than Chinese. They have a sign that looks like the bass clef in music. And when they put it behind a word, it means of. So if they write Canada and put this little sign after it, that means of Canada or Canadian. And this little sign is no. Canada no. That means you're of Canada or you're Canadian. America no is American. Nippon no is Japanese. Nihongo. Now there's where they change the N to G, and that's the Japanese language, Nihongo. You can't write Japan in Japanese. There's no such word. This will become quite a shock to a lot of people. It is absolutely impossible to write Japan in Japanese because there is no such word. They call their company Nippon, you see, or as we say, Nippon, but Nippon, Nihon, even. There's quite an argument there. They've got a character that looks exactly like a 7, and it's got two sounds depending on what part of the country you're in. We said foo because we thought that's what they were saying, and all the civilian guards in our camp had an armband. And let me tell you, if you didn't wear an armband in Japan, you were nobody. You were insignificant. Everybody, it seemed, had an armband. So these civilian guards had army uniforms, a little different type cap. They had the factory cap, the same as we wore, and this 7 on their arm. And all our boys call them 7-Up, obviously. And one day I said, what's this 7-Up, 7-Up? I said, you wouldn't understand, it's the name of a drink. You know Coca-Cola? Yeah, 7-Up, same. Why me 7-Up? Because that's 7 in English. No, that's foo. Now, that was the first part of what he was. He was a guard. He was a fushimban, or a guard. So they just put the first character, just like we would abbreviate something in, and that's what it stood for. But the word for blanket is mofu, you see? But you go up north, and that foo becomes hu, and it's mohu. And I couldn't understand what this guy was trying to say to me. Moo, moo. And he picked it up, and I says, mofu. Yeah, Moho. Because it's a different accent up there, you see. Otherwise, everybody pretty well speaks the same language in Japan, you know, except for a few dialects. I understand there's no swear words in Japanese, so I understand. Now, about the war's end.
Did you stay at the shipyard all the time until the end of the war?
No, well, I was just telling you about this this blanket thing there. They put us in a train and sent us about 180 miles north of Tokyo to a place called Sendai. It was a scene last year or 2 years ago, a tremendous tidal wave. The whole city was practically wrecked. Tremendous tidal wave at Sendai. And we worked in a mine there, right down in the coal field, digging coal. And
did you work right down in the mine?
Right in the mine, right down the coal face, yes. And I won a prize. I've got the thing there. And they gave me a piece of Japanese underwear, which is just like an Indian breech cloth. I'll show it to you. And I got taken out of the mine for that. And put up for shoveling coal up. They said, the guy actually told me, the interpreter, he said, "You've come out of hell into heaven." So I was shoveling coal up. Upstairs, about 3 miles from the mine in the field.
The interpreter, was he quite good at interpreting, or was he couldn't speak good English or good Japanese? Or
there was one interpreter, he was quite an elderly chap, spoke flawless and fluent English because he was in the diplomatic service, and he had an outfit for every day of the week. He would come into the camp one day dressed as an aviator, with just like Lindbergh, and the goggles and the leather hat and the scarf around the neck, and he was about 4'2", a typical Jap. The next day he would be dressed in plus fours and an English shooting stick. Another time he'd be in a frock coat and a top hat. He had the whole bit. And let me tell you about Red Cross parcels, let's come to think of it. Because there was a piece in the paper last night by Gene Telfer in the Tribune. And he was saying that America is the richest country in the world, and he was a prisoner of war in Germany, and they were getting margarine in their food parcels, and he couldn't understand why. And I was wondering if he was mistaken, because we got butter in ours, but it said clearly on it, preserved butter. And it naturally couldn't taste like butter, because after all, it laid around in some ship hold for 2 years. And you can believe it or not, I think everybody will tell you the same story. Two men, one parcel, 1 year. So we were over there 4 years. I got a parcel. After I'd been captured for 11 months, I got a British parcel. And then after that, two men, one parcel. Two men, one parcel. I never saw a Canadian parcel. But I spoke to Americans that come into our camp that had had Canadian parcels in the Philippines. And when they told us there was peanut butter in it and a whole pound of butter, well, let me tell you, see, we got no fat of any kind. None whatsoever. During the early days of my captivity, most people had diarrhea and starting of dysentery, and I was the exact opposite. I went 36 days without a bowel movement. And I really thought that must be something. It must be a world's record, but I found out later that it's not. You know, it's unusual, but it's not a world record. And I went to the doctor and I told him, he said, "Well, I'll try and get some Epsom salts and see if we can get you moved." So he was able to speak to the Japanese doctor that came in once a week, and he got a dose of Epsom salts, and I took it. Nothing. So he got another dose, and finally, it moved me. And maybe I was lucky to be plugged up like that all the time. I didn't get this diarrhea for the longest time, but when I got it, boy, I had a voice like a soprano. Your voice just rolled. I became so dehydrated. And it showed in your eyes. You could always tell the guy next to you when he was getting sick. It was just a look in his eyes. We'd tell each other, "You're going to be sick tomorrow." You get that stupid staring look in your eyes. And always right. And the water would just run out of you.
coal mines.
Yeah, well, at the coal mines, we worked hard there, and I finally got out of the coal mines. In the meantime, there's well, quite a few fellows have died, eh? Quite a few fellows have died in... Oh, I'll tell you an odd thing that happened. I met a colored fella the first week that we were prisoners of war in this camp, and they had civilians in there, too. Half of them, one was a colored fella, and he was a trombonist like me in an American jazz band. And I never did know what happened to him. They just came and took him out of there because he was a civilian, you see.
This was in the coal mine, wasn't it?
No. This was way back, first week of our captivity. I've jumped back because I wanted to tell you something before I forget. Well, there was no tobacco in that camp, and I had quit smoking when I saw these sailors that had blown their heads off. That finished me. I thought, they've seen something. We're not going to be very well treated. There's one thing we're not going to get is an issue of beefsteaks and cigarettes. And I quit right then and there, and I had a full package, full tin of player cigarettes, 50. And I hit it, and I hung on to it. And when the four friends of ours used to sit around and try to play some cards while we were starving slowly to death in the sun, I would go for a walk and come back and say, an officer gave me a cigarette. And I finally get rid of the 50 cigarettes, and they would husband this cigarette. They would break it open and they re-roll it in the Indian Army toilet paper, which is perfect for cigarettes, like a brown cigarette paper, like a wheat paper. And they gave a good strong smoke, you see. So all they wanted was a few puffs, and I rationed out this 50. Well, one of this four, he got to me. He wanted my watch to buy cigarettes, and I said, no, my wife scrubbed floors to get that watch. And it's a kind of a wedding present. I'd only been married a short time. Give it up. Besides, there's only two watches in the whole of the camp. However, he came to me one day, and he actually got down on his hands and knees, and he said, Jesus came to me last night in a vision. And he said, he's going to give me a sign. He says, you see that boat out there in the harbor that sunk? He said, he's going to raise that boat. And when he does, we'll be out of here. And he said, if I could only have a few cigarettes just to keep me going, because it won't be very long now, he wouldn't have come to me. So I said, all right, Cliff, you want the watch that bad? You can have it. He said, I'll give you $100 for it. I said, I don't want your $100. Just replace the watch. So he wrote a chit to the paymaster, duly witnessed and dated and signed. I still have it. And through the years, he was sent to one camp, I was sent to another, and we were just split up. And about 3 years ago, I was over doing some business for the Hong Kong Veterans Association. I saw a list of survivors, and I saw this Cliff Newcomb's name on it. So I obtained his address in Seattle, and I wrote him a registered letter saying how glad I was to hear that he had survived, and I too had survived. And here's a photostat copy of your promise to replace my watch. And he never answered me. Then the next year I saw him in person in Winnipeg. And he said, well, they don't make Rolex watches anymore. He said, I walked all over Seattle and I couldn't find a Rolex watch. So he said, I didn't know what to do. Well, I said, okay, you know what to do now. Here I am now, I want my watch. Get me something. And, well, he says, you know, I didn't smoke all those cigarettes myself. I gave some of them to my friends, you know. Well, I said, how does that affect me? You got down on your hands and knees, you begged for the watch, and you wrote me a note saying that you would replace it. So, come on, how about it? Well, he left Winnipeg the next day, and I haven't heard from him since. But I'm still going to write him because I think he's got a moral obligation. He can't be poor. I've been told he owns a newspaper, but I don't know how true it is. But since they awarded us all a 50% pension, at least I know he's getting 50% pension, and that's why I've been putting it off writing him, telling him that he's liable to go down for posterity at the Manitoba Museum he'll be on tape, and maybe his picture will be in the museum there as the biggest piper in the Winnipeg Grenadiers. So anyways,
the war's end, with
my knowledge of Japanese and able to pump the people that were over us, and I was working outside with a select group of about 12 men. We were shoveling cars full of coal and then tipping them over on their side. Believe it or not, we would actually push these box cars over off the track with poles, and then the coal would slide down a tin chute into a big hopper. Then we'd manhandle the car back up on the track and then push it up, and it would be finally hooked up onto a trolley and taken up to the mine again and be filled again and come down, and we would do this, you see. So they had a civilian guard of about 18 years old, and I was getting to him, and I was speaking pretty good Japanese then, and I was really getting to him, and I was really teasing the life out of him, because I knew how far I could go, see. He wasn't a very brave chap, and he wasn't in the army. The army was 300 or 400 yards out in the field in a sentry box, you see. Well, one day he says, "You've got to dig Erich over in this clay." Now this was August the 14th and the war was over. And he issued this shovel and we had to dig this huge air raid shelter, but the size of this room, as you see here, you know, 32 by 16, into the clay. And no more coal, just dig air raid shelter, you see. Well, I know now all they're doing was just keeping us busy, you see. Well, in the middle of this digging we heard firing and we run out, and there was our first sight of American fighter planes from the carriers down real low, and they just shot up that sentry box and beat it. And those soldiers took off and they threw their rifles down and they ran across the rice fields, and we never did see them for the rest of the day. So a friend of mine, this lives over the next street, said, "I'm going to go get some of their tea." So we ran out of this airy shelter that we were digging and ran across this 200 or 300 yards to this shack and got their kettle of tea and started back, and another plane came and saw him. Well, I guess from the air, he's just another Jap. And he let go with these machine gun bullets. Well, Ernie just dove head first into that airy shelter, tea kettle and all, and that wasn't head forcibly. And we said, "Well, Ernie, we found out one thing. They aren't red, white, and blue stars on American planes. The whole planes are painted gray and it's a white star. That's how low they were." Well, the next day we were going to work and I was the last man out of the camp. And there was a big long sign hanging on a meat hook. Sign about 6 feet long and about 2 feet wide, with Japanese writing on it saying it was a Sendai prisoners of war camp, which I could read. And the most miserable guard of all was on duty at the gate, and he yelled at me as I passed by, and he yelled again. So I figured, well, what now? So I turned around to see what he wanted, and he took the sign off the hook and he threw it on the ground and he jumped up and down on it. Now I thought, that's a very strange thing. Well, the arguments I'm having with this kid out of work, and they're not pushing us, they're not making us work. The American planes flying around and shooting up everybody. Plus the fact that we'd seen a Japanese battalion marching down to the sea a week before, singing their songs, and the officers on the horseback. And the day before, they were coming back like the retreat from Moscow, and even the officer wasn't smoking cigarettes, he was smoking what we call a hair pipe. It's a long pipe with a bowl about the size of an acorn. And they used to smoke something that looks like oakum. It wasn't tobacco, I don't know what it was. And you only got one puff out of that. You filled this bowl, you took exactly one puff, and you knocked it out in your hand while it was still hot, and you filled the pipe again, then you put this on top, the dottle on top of the new fresh pipe full, and you took one more puff again, and then you knocked that off, and you kept doing this until you were finished. I thought, boy, things must be tough in the Japanese army if the officers are going to smoke that cheap thing, and they looked dejected. Well, of course, we didn't know that they had been told the war was over. This was the morning of the 17th. So about 11 o'clock, the phone rang in the hut, and I said to the chaps, "I know what that is," and I threw my shovel away. I said, "The war's over. I'm taking this chance." He says, "You're crazy. Well, can't throw that shovel away. He said, well, I know that's what it is. And they came over, and the guard said, everybody, Atsumari, everybody line up. So we argued with him. We thought, well, we'll find out what it's all about. He wanted us to march over the mountain. We said, no, too tired. We want to go through the village. Okay. And there was pumpkins growing along the side of the road there, and plums, and green apples. And he never stopped us from touching anything. You see? So we knew there was something wrong. So we got back to the mine camp. There was only two Japanese girls there in the whole of the mine camp, and they were crying. So I kept my mine shit for my helmet, which I wasn't wearing that day because I was working outside. You see, I still have it. It's a little wooden shit with the word lamp written on it in Japanese and my number. So there was no Japanese around, nobody to tell us what to do, so we just marched back to the camp. But there was nothing going on inside, except that we all had a darn good idea the war was over, but we had no official confirmation. It wasn't until well on into the next day, the 18th, around noon. I think it was Dr. Reed said, well, we finally got the word. The war is over. It's been over for 3 days. But we're to stay put. We're not to do anything. And one especially miserable head guard disappeared, which is probably a good thing. We would have probably hung him. And they said the Japanese have been given instructions by General MacArthur to provide us with sheets. And we're to write PW on it and put it up on the sides of the mountains, on three sides, to guide the planes in. So the planes came in, and we estimated they dropped 7 tons of food and supplies, boots, hats, clothes, shaving, peaches, everything. And then the small fighter planes came over and dropped a side of beef and a full set of carving knives and even a few loaves of bread. And then another plane came over and said, this is nothing, wait till we drop the beer. But they never did. then it was very sad. One of the B-29s dropping food to us didn't come out of a climb and hit the mountain. Exploded and the whole crew was lost. They were about 5 miles away. So that was very sad. So by that time I had a raging fever, so I had a tag put on me and I was... They had just finished building a railroad track into our camp, by the way, to take the coal out. But for some strange reason, there was a rumor going around. They were building a new dining hall for the coming winter. This was in August. They were building a new dining hall for the coming winter. There wasn't any dining hall at all, you see. You used to eat on the fly, as you might say. And they backed the train right in on this brand new track that had never been used, flat cars, and loaded us all on there, and I was put on a stretcher and put on there, and all the Japanese villagers came around there, and they had a huge sign in English, goodbye, brave Canadian soldiers, come back again. Really funny.
So you went from the camp to Tokyo,
and through exactly the same station where the people had spit at us and jeered at us, through there.
What did Tokyo look like at that time?
Oh, you know, that's I'm glad you mentioned that. They took us on a train ride from Sendai. They backed these flat cars out of our camp at about 8 miles across the rice fields into Sendai. And there they transferred us to a proper, regular Japanese train, except it's all in miniature. The seats are like if you walk into a great one schoolroom. The seats are also small and cramped, you see. And we are all given a net bag of Japanese iron rations. There was a whole tin of meat and all sorts of little hard candies and hard biscuits, and this was what they used to the Japanese soldiers for the jungle. If they were if they were ever stuck and couldn't scrounge, they were allowed to eat this while we handled these to the population as we went through. But you were saying, what did Tokyo look like? From Sendai into Tokyo, as far as the eye could see, believe me, it might as well have been the ocean. Utter devastation. The odd tree, the odd telephone pole standing, smoldering. The rest, flat, nothing. But we pulled into Tokyo train yards and we saw, about a 6'5" American soldier standing there with a machine gun. That was the first one we'd seen, right in the railroad yards, all by himself. So we didn't see too much of Tokyo. I was too sick anyways. I was taken right off and put in a van, a Red Cross van, and taken to the dockside and had all my clothes taken off and examined and brushed up on the hospital ship, the Marigold. Stayed on there for 3 days, and then a guy came along and woke me up. Said, "Here, tie this on your shirt." "What's that for?" "You're flying home." I said, "I don't want to fly home." As well, "You're flying home anyway." So I thought, well, okay, if I'm flying home, I'm flying home. So took us out to the airfield. They stood us on something that looked like an elevator. I'd never seen one because we'd been away too long. But what it was a heister. Apparently everybody knows what a heister is. I said this was a huge thing. And 16 of us stood on this pallet, and it just raised us right up about 3 floors, because a B-29 is a huge plane. And there were 16 bunks in that plane, and that's who they were reserved for. 16 prisoners of war, or ex-prisoners of war, they called us. And we got those bunks, and this plane took off. It hadn't been away more than 15 minutes before one of the engines caught fire. And the crew said if this was a bombing mission, we'd keep going. We'd just fed this engine, and we'd put the fire, and we'd keep going. But he said, "We've got strict orders from General MacArthur." He said, "We're going back." So the turnaround came back, landed in the same place, took us to an ex-Army hospital where they had just absolutely run bulldozers through the corridors, taken all the Japanese equipment out. The Americans had it, piled it in one great big huge festering pile of bandages and blood and guns went there, and put all their own equipment in there. So we slept there that night, and the next day they had a new engine fitted into that same plane. And away we went. We flew to Saipan.
And how long were you there for?
Well, I was in the hospital in Saipan for 3 or 4 days. I had a fever and watched a few movies. Saw Judy Garland and Meet Me in St. Louis. I always remember that. And Brian, Don Levy, and Don Whitmaginty, I remember that. Remember the big sign. Now, this is very topical. There was a big sign on the edge of the camp. "Danger. Japanese still in here. Do not enter unless armed." Now, 2 weeks ago, what's this, March the 8th, 2 or 3 weeks ago, they found the surviving Japanese on Guam. Well, that was the next island to us, Saipan. There were still found soldiers on Saipan years after the war was over. In fact, they say some used to sneak down and watch the movies. It was pretty humorous.
And from Saipan, where did you go?
From Saipan, we flew in a PBY, that's a naval patrol bomber, and there were bunks in there for the prisoners of war only. And when we were in the bunks and settled, and they gave everybody a paper bag as we went on the plane, and when we were settled, then the crew chief said, "All right, I've got room for 8 more." And there were admirals came in behind us, and they sat up in staggered seats up in the tail of this plane, like in a balcony in a theater. And they were happy, believe me. They all had their bag of sandwiches too. So I got in this bunk, and I drew the curtains. I just didn't want to fly anymore, but I mean, I knew I had to, so I had a little sleep, woke up, ate my sandwiches, fell asleep again. And then I felt somebody shaking me on the shoulder. "Is that you, Morrison?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Did you?" I said, "Oh yeah, I finished my sandwiches." "Oh no," he said, "I knew there was something wrong." He said, "No, that's not what I mean. Come on with me." So I got out of the bunk and went up to the galley where they flew the plane from. And they had a huge thermos designed hot stove there. And they had a full turkey dinner in there waiting for me. He said, "We knew how many there were of you." He says, "We all got one, and there was one for each of you guys. This is our treat to you." And there was one over, we couldn't figure out who missed it. So they let me have a leak in the big, big bull that trailed out of the plane there, and I went back there, and we came down at a place called Johnson Island, I think it was. Yeah, Johnson Island, and there was a big, dark cook in pure white clothes and a big chef's hat, and it was about 6 o'clock in the morning. It was just roasting. It was pretty close to the equator, you know. He says, "How would ham and eggs suit you boys?" "Fine, bring them on." There was a pantry there. He gave us a bag with books, more razors, more toothpaste, more washcloths, more soap. Every place we stopped, they were, I think they called them musette bags. Anyways, they kept loading us down with these books. I still have them too, by the way. That was Johnson Island, and then we flew to another one called Rota, which must be a short hop, maybe 500 miles. Came down there, and then from Rota we flew to Honolulu. Came down there, and we were put into the naval hospital there. And I still have the pass to get out from the naval hospital, fingerprinted and description and everything, Canadian Army. And they issued me clothes in that hospital. And I didn't know, but they gave me an officer's hat. I didn't know this. And I went with an American sergeant named Costello. He and I went roaming through the town. And we come to a bar, and he says, "Boy," he said, "do I feel like a drink?" I said, "Well, it doesn't bother me. I really don't drink, but I'll go in with you, and I'll even have a drink with you, but it doesn't really bother me." But he says, "Look at this line here." Well, all the Americans were up to 2 grades. If you were a private, you were a corporal. If you were a corporal, you were a staff sergeant, so on and so forth. See, they were all automatically upgraded. So he was carrying his staff sergeants on there because he was upgraded. And there was a sergeant, policeman on duty. So he outranked this guy. And he walked up to this guy. He said, "We've just landed from Japan. I've been a prisoner there for 4 years. The guy said, "Say no more. You 2 guys on that table, you've been in there enough, get out." They had to get up and get out. And he and I went in and took their place. So that was quite a thing. Then we went and had a haircut, and it was the girls were speaking Japanese in the barbershop. Well, when I spoke to them in Japanese, they just about dropped. Because they were American Japanese, but they still spoke Japanese, They were as American as you or I or anybody was. I said, "Where did you learn? Where did you learn that?" I said, "I learned it the hard way. I learned it over in your beloved ancestor's country." And they said, "Well, you sure speak it good." So that was quite an experience. I had a haircut. I had a haircut in Japan before I left, and that was really an experience. A girl was about 18 years old, and I took a guy's bicycle off. I bust out of the camp, and I took a guy's bicycle off. I think it was about time I asserted myself. And I said, "I'll come back, and I'll give you a pack of cigarettes and a pair of boots for your bike when I'm finished with it." And I did, too, because, I had 2 pair of boots, brand new, that was dropped by air, you see. They dropped a pair and a half of boots for everybody in camp, so I was one of the lucky ones. I got an extra pair. So I drove into this little town on the outskirts of Sendai and looked around for a barber shop. Went in, and this girl was terrified. I could just see, here's me, a white soldier, you know. And the first thing I said to her was, "Don't be afraid. I'm a Canadian soldier. And I was a prisoner here. Don't be afraid. I want a haircut." Sat down there. The poor thing had a sliver of soap, you know, but she would have thrown away. And she lathered me up, and I wasn't prepared for what she did. She not only shaved me, she shaved the back of my eyeballs. She shaved all along the edges of my ears. It was really an experience. Then she didn't want to take any money, and of course, the more she didn't want, because the money was no good to me. So I just left it there. And she wasn't afraid. By the time I left, she wasn't afraid. But oh boy, you could see it written all over her face. The same as a lady when we were on the way from from Sendai to Tokyo on the train and had stopped for to let us have a drink of green tea. They'd been told, you've got to supply these men with tea every time the train stops, hot tea. And there was thousands of Japanese just milling on the platforms, wanting to get home and get away and all this, you see. And there was a young girl there, about 20, and a baby on her back. And I, as I say, I spoke very good Japanese, and I walked up to her and I said, don't be afraid. Nobody will hurt you. I said, could I give your, is it a boy or a girl? And I knew it was a boy, because I could tell by the way the hair was cut, you see. And she said, it was a boy. I said, can I give him some chocolate? And she just didn't answer, so I just had a bar of chocolate that had been dropped from the plane, and I took it out and I put it in her hand. And she said, thank you very much. But she was afraid, let me tell you, she really was. What did I close this thing for?
Well, I think we're as far as Honolulu.
Yeah, the war's end. Yeah, we got to Honolulu, and from Honolulu, well, of course, I stayed in the hospital there a few days, and then I was flown in a commercial edition of a B-29, with stewardesses on it and everything. And once again, an engine caught fire, but they were able to get this one out. So we flew from there right into San Francisco, and then we had quite a time. We got off the plane at San Francisco, which is really Oakland. You don't land in San Francisco. San Francisco's on an island, evidently. You land in Oakland, which is the mainland. And they had a huge limousine waiting for there. I guess it would be about a 12-passenger limousine, and a Navy girl driving it. And most of us kissed the earth. I'm not ashamed to tell you, when we got off that plane, we made it. And I know, that's what I said. I made it. I made it. I'm home. Take these gentlemen to the Letterman General Hospital. It's near the Presidio. So we get in this car, and she drives around and around, and she's got a boyfriend to meet, which she doesn't tell anybody. She gets thoroughly lost. And she crossed that Golden Gate Bridge 3 times. She was so lost. And the funny part of it was, the Letterman General Hospital is just at the very end of the Golden Gate Bridge. And then underneath, like underneath the Salter Street Bridge, there's a street there. Well, that's where the Letterman General Hospital, that's the Presidio. It's an old Spanish fort and parade ground, you see, and a parading place. So we got into there. And they told us they had some very sad news for us. The plane before us had crashed and 11 of the men had been killed. So we didn't feel too happy about that.
Were there Canadians on
the plane? Yeah, oh yeah, oh sure. Yeah, yeah. And there were 16 of us on the plane that we were on. I just can't remember how many other Americans were there. It's too hazy, you know. And we sat together as a group, and the seats were 3 across. Well, I know I was sitting by this Costello, this American. I was with him all the time for some strange reason. And they said, now, when you get up to your ward, get your bed, and put your kit bag there, you're allowed a phone call to any place in the world. You go down to the main lounge and just tell the girl there that you want a phone, wherever you want a phone, and don't let it worry you if you don't remember where you lived, or don't let it worry you if your wife has moved, because we will get the police chief out of bed. We have the authority. You just tell them your name and where you live and your last address and who you are and who you want to talk to. Give them all the names you can and we'll get you. And it was true. I had no idea where my wife lived. She didn't live in the same place. When I left, we lived at 412 Kennedy Street. She was living in the Ambassador Apartments, that big block there on Hargrave Street, you see. So it only took them 10 minutes to get her. That's all. And they were just going out, she told me later on. They had just got a telegram saying that I was officially landed in the States and I was safe, that I would be home soon. So they were going out to a restaurant downtown near Eaton's to celebrate. And they were just out the door and the phone rang. And somebody went back and answered, today it's for you. So it was me on the phone, and I couldn't talk to her. I was too shy, and I was tongue-tied. I just said, yeah, I'm in San Francisco here, and I'm all right, and I said, I can't say anymore. I don't know what to do. So I said, I guess I'll just have to hang up. So I did, and she never left that chair. She just sat there. After I composed myself, and about an hour's time went by, I went and I tried to eat a turkey dinner, and I couldn't. I just picked at it. And I went back to the operator, and I said, boy, I said, I made an awful fool of myself. I said, you got my wife? And I said, all I did was said about three words to her. I couldn't say anything to her. Could I call again? He said, certainly, it doesn't make a difference. So, boy, the first ring. She said, I knew you'd call back. So I told her that I would be leaving San Francisco by train, and I would be going up to Vancouver to a place called Little Mountain Barracks. And she said, I've already been told by the Red Cross that I can get a train ride, I can get a priority. And they did. They kicked somebody off the train and put her on. And she got there to Vancouver a day ahead of me. So we have the photographs there of our meeting. So that's about all I can remember.
And did you return to Winnipeg with her then, did you?
Yeah, but I had a month's rest in Vancouver first. I stayed with my mother and father on Broughton Street. And when I was there last year, on our holidays, they were just tearing her apartment block down, and Guinnesses are putting up a huge 40-story building with a revolving rooftop restaurant or something.
And after your leave, you came back to Winnipeg then?
I did, yes.
And did you enter hospital again?
Well, we were all on convalescent leave, and they gave us all the vitamins in the world, and we had to go out twice a week to report to a doctor. And they kept us up, and I just wanted to get back to work. I had invested some money in a bakery with my brother-in-law, and I just wanted to get to work. So I persuaded them that they should discharge me. And they said, after 6 months, we'll discharge you. So I think I was one of the first to be discharged.
When was that?
Well, it would be in 1946 sometime. A lot of them stayed on a lot longer, because you don't forget they were on army pay and full rations and allowances, you know, and a lot of them liked to drink. But I was going to make that money do something. So we operated this bakery for a while, but I finally sold out to him, and I bought a new apartment block with somebody I met through a very strange circumstance, just by crossing the street to get out of the sun. It's the strangest thing. We got talking, and we found out between the two of us we could just finance the $75,000 block between the two of us, $15,000 down, and we could buy it. And believe it or not, the mortgage was 4.25%. I mean, they're around 10 now, you see. So we stayed there for 9 years, and then I sold out to him. He just died recently, painting a roof of a house in Chilliwack. He was 67 years old, and he fell off the roof and had a heart attack. So I then entered the... when I bought the block, I also started the same day. When I bought the block, I started with the Mantle telephone system, and I've been there ever since. I've been there 22 years.
And what is your position there?
I'm in the, what they call a stock analyst.